was on my face, yeah. Ooh. And baby, baby, I'd rather be blind, boy, than to see you walk away from me.
Once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarca Barrett, and Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guest is New York literary agent John Ware. John has been on before, and I'm always delighted to have him back. He's a wonderful agent in New York, and he has an interesting background. A lot of agents do, but his is particularly interesting in that he was a philosophy major at Cornell and went to graduate school then at Northwestern and received a degree in English literature. He started the John A. Ware Literary Agency in 1978, after 8 years as an editor at Doubleday, 7 years of which he taught the industry-wide editorial workshop at NYU, and a year as an agent with James Brown Associates, Curtis Brown Limited. Let's bring him on. Hi, John.
Barbara, hi. But I have to start by saying I didn't complete the master's. As much as I love books, and since I was about three, studying English was not for me. Studying literature was not for me.
Well, you
philosophy,
were,
yes, but
you were a poet, though.
I have written poetry, but I can't really, I can't claim it because I came to a point where I stopped. I've come close at the New Yorker. That's probably my greatest claim to fame on a poem about an aging pitcher. But the truth is that maybe this sounds unreasonable, but to me it's the truth, and that is that I'm so involved, was as an editor and am as an agent, with other people's words that as much as I love words, it's as though there's no room anymore for my own creative area with words. I need to go to a concert, go for a run, watch a ball game, do something different to get
sure,
away.
Sure. Well, you know, I
have to say,
as we were before we went on, we chatted a little bit, and I said that some of our listeners have heard you before, but a lot of listeners are new and haven't heard you, haven't had the pleasure of meeting you over my show. So I wonder if you would talk a little bit about actually how you got into being an agent.
Well, I'd been an editor at Doubleday for 8 years, and very happily so, and really had no plans to become an agent, wasn't looking. But a friend of mine, a literary agent, who, interestingly, I had never acquired a book from as an editor. You know, as you know, they, writers and literary agents, are the editor's source of supply. And so I had had many submissions from Jim, and I'd never happened to acquire a book from him, but what stood out were our famous publishing lunches, as our, you know, I guess legendary in our industry, which I can say more about categorically too in a minute. But Jim and I, regardless of being, I think it was about 35 years apart, I think good humor admits of no demographics that matter. And so we just broke each other up. The sense of humor was just hysterical and constant. And so Jim, who was not particularly looking either, hired me, asked me if I wanted to come and join his agency. And I think by that time, as happy as I was at Doubleday, Doubleday at that time, it's still large within the Bertelsmann combine. At that time, I think the Doubleday entity itself, which is now smaller, was about 400 people and four floors and et cetera. And, of course, every agency is smaller than every publisher. So, you know, we're talking about 400 people versus, I think, there was a staff of five, two other agents and two assistants, and that was it. The office was in the Allianz Française, the only business in this wonderful building in Manhattan where French is taught and students come and go. And really, I think it was the change in size and ambiance of the organization as much as anything, and my friendship with James Brown that induced me to change, because, and I still give this answer, Barbara, to people who ask about the difference, the jobs at heart, there are many differences, but at heart, editors and literary agents read something. And if they read it and they like it, one submits to the other, and you end up negotiating with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So you really, again, at heart, it's the same job. Now, it's true that editors, as sort of project managers of books, have many more tasks with many departments, all the relevant departments at a publisher, whereas literary agents primarily work with the editors and then our clients, the writers. But again, fundamentally, the job is very similar.
Mm.
It is true that I was glad to get away from meetings and such institutional things. I was glad for the independence. I was glad not to have to go to other people and get readings on a book that I liked and wanted to handle professionally. Obviously, as an agent, you know, there are no such committees. Even the youngest literary agent inside an agency, I hope this is still true, is an independent entity. He or she can read something and take it on and try to place it.
Sure.
So you're freer in that way as an agent.
Talk about what you handle. What kind of stuff do you handle?
I handle, I have real pride about what I handle because I like to handle material, whether it is fiction or nonfiction. And I do represent much, much more nonfiction, but I cannot not represent fiction. I like it too much. I read too much of it for pleasure. But even with that imbalance, I handle them both. And in each case, the material has to be something of what I consider to be big game, something consequential. I don't mean to sound snobbish, but I don't handle Hollywood sex and violence and other such genres that I think tend to follow a familiar pattern within them, whether that be male action adventure or at least classic romance with readers in mind, men and women in the case of the latter two. I handle biography, history, current affairs, investigative journalism, some nature. Memoir, certainly, I think no personal memoir, I think I can generalize. No personal memoir, I think, unless you're a famous person. No individual other than such as memoir can be published unless there are ideas, themes, a context in there that hook to the larger world.
Sure.
So where there is such, I have handled memoir. I'm open to folklore, Americana, and certainly the offbeat. I do some far out books. For example, I think even I talked about this on your previous show, the memoir of a Chicago bicycle messenger.
Sure.
A very successful book for Random House, and this 25-year-old kid was describing well beyond kickback days riding around Chicago. He was an urban visionary of his own kind. Admittedly, a lot of it was anti-car, but nonetheless, he absolutely was an urban planner without portfolio. So that was sort of a larger in there. Interestingly, he is undertaking a new, absolutely appropriate memoir with those hooks to larger topics that I will see, I think, in June. His name is Travis Cully.
Huh.
And Travis, not to spend too much time on one book, but Travis reckons that he was not, from his upbringing, truly literate until he was 18 years old, that far along.
Huh.
He came from a broken family, a very poor section of Miami, bad schools. His mother had no time with her two jobs. No dyslexia. Maybe a little psychological effect of his father leaving the family, but no functional problems that had to do with his eyesight or reading per se. And this is going to be, and I think very inspirational, Random House agrees, very inspirational, although I don't think necessarily he realizes that. He's really writing to capture what it was for him to be in the dark regarding you know, reading material of any kind until he was fully competent, he feels, at 18. And then the glory of books for him since that time.
Hmm.
So he has been able to hit on another book about himself that nonetheless has some reach because it involves, I have a cousin who has reading problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can reach to a larger audience.
Sure. If you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with John Ware today. He's a literary agent in New York City. So when something comes in, when you get a query letter, or I would think most relationships with you begin with a query letter.
They do, unless there's some sort of a personal referral.
Yeah.
And someone just calls. But even in the case of a friend who calls, I usually say to them, you know, thanks for calling, and I appreciate Bill's having referred you to me. But you know, you and I both work with the written word, not the spoken word. So this was a great phone call we've had, and I am interested in the project. But can you still write me a simple, succinct, one-page letter so I can just see you express a summary of it in front of my eyes?
Sure.
Because that's the way we both work.
So then,
the query letter to answer your question.
So the letter comes in, and how much do you have? Do you read them all?
I read them all.
And how soon or how little time does it take, actually, before you know? I mean, will you have to read the whole letter? Or can you tell sometimes in the first sentence whether this is going to be someone you're going to want to see more from or not?
Well, again, it's Travis's night. When I was reading his, I was dialing his phone when I hit the second paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
I was so taken by it. Usually I read the whole thing. Occasionally, I put a question mark on a post-it and set something aside for a couple of days and have to muse a little more. But, you know, most of those I end up not asking to see.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say the ones that I am taken with, it does hit quickly.
And is it always a gut feeling? Is it something that you say, this is marketable? I mean, what is the thing that happens? What are you reacting to?
You hit it first, Barbara. It's the gut. It doesn't even... For it to be sufficient for me to move on, write a letter seeking 50 pages or picking up the phone, it really is the gut. For me, I'm only speaking for me, the marketable certainly comes because I guess it's built into doing this job for a long time, but it's absolutely second, thinking about circumscribing an audience and marketing considerations. Absolutely the first thing is the gut, without question. The second, the marketing isn't even close. It's not even a close second. It definitely comes. It's functional. It has to, but it's way second.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's really the feeling of excitement. That's what you know, I go by, and I try to take on, and pretty much do take on only what really excites me. Not something that is just marketable, where I can read something and say, you know, I think I can place this. And it's interesting, and you know, you hear the qualifiers in my voice, and I hear them myself when I'm saying that kind of thing to myself, where I'm hedging because I'm not excited.
Mm-hmm.
When the excitement's there, it's palpable for me, you know, and I'm saying, wow, this is just my kind of book.
Do you ever scout, do you look at literary journals or magazines and see a story or an essay or see something and say, I really have to find this writer and see if they have representation,
you know,
see if they're
working on
a book?
I should do it more often. And here, this is the one thing I sort of fault my mentor, James Brown, with. I was in the habit of doing that as an editor very much when I was an editor at Doubleday. And when I went to work with Jim as a young literary agent, and I told him that I used to do that sort of scouting and even and commissioning of books when I would find, you know, come upon someone, he said to me, and I took it in like gospel as a kid at the time, he said, you know, I don't think you'll be doing as much of that, maybe even went as far as saying not appropriate. And he said, here's the reason. He said, when you're writing as an editor to a writer whose work you've read in a journal, let's say, you are, just by your letterhead alone, you are in effect holding out the possibility of publication by the mere presence of, say, Doubleday on that letterhead. But when you write as a literary agent, at the time it was very effective. He said, you're only holding out the possibility of service. And he said, that's not the same as holding out, in effect, a bound book at the end of the road when you write on behalf of a publishing house. And at the time, that made great sense to me, and I sort of gave up the habit of that kind of scouting.
Sure.
The truth is, I've been busy enough, with submissions and so forth in the years since that. And reading time comes very hard, Barbara, in the journals. You know, even the beloved New Yorker, time for that comes hard.
Mm-hmm.
So I really haven't had the time or made the precious time to do that sort of scouting with a full plate.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with John Ware, a literary agent in New York City. Who or what determines whether a book becomes hardcover or trade paperback, and is one preferable? Is it better to get a hardback out so you have another go around with it becoming paperback, hopefully?
Generally, it is assumed, and I think it is the case with the kinds of books that I do, that they come out in hardcover. And a big reason for that is that they need review attention to make their way. They need serious review attention. When I say I do big game, I do substantive books, they really rely on whether it's radio programs like yours or print media. They rely on that kind of attention to make their way to readers, and one hopes the word of mouth that follows. But I must say that this is turning around all the time and back and forth, and I get educated on it. I am presently getting educated with one client of mine who has published two hardcover books and wrote a novel that was not right for her publisher, and in submitting it, we have an offer from, I guess I'll leave all the names out at the moment. It is a commitment, but in any case, we have a firm offer from a very fine quality trade paperback publisher to do it in paper. And they have made quite a reasonable case to us that this would be a good place to start with this novel. Now, one of the reasons they've made that case is this is, it is a piece of fiction. It's kind of a southern rural setting. It is the kind of book, although I don't like to acknowledge this, but I think the editor is right that this is not necessarily going to get a lot of review attention. And of course, as anybody who follows books knows, just in whatever one's hometown is, the number of pages devoted to book reviewing is down to begin with. And the fiction that gets attended to, unless it's big bestsellers, and sometimes they don't get or need the attention, is very literary fiction. This isn't really literary fiction, which is mostly what I do handle. And so my client, a veteran of two hardcover books of nonfiction, and I have been comfortably persuaded that this is absolutely a way for her to begin her fiction career. And there are examples. I know one, for example, is the best-selling writer Jan Caron.
Sure.
A Viking author.
Yeah.
Jan Caron began with two trade paperbacks, maybe from this imprint, I don't know, but began with two trade paperbacks as the original publication. They got a lot of attention, a lot of word of mouth, maybe not review attention, but there was enough of a groundswell that then on book three, she moved, and of course since the rest is history, she moved to hardcover at Viking. And has been a great success. So we were persuaded of this. You know, it's funny. It goes back and forth with paperback original publication in terms of the attitudes of the industry and maybe of book buyers. I don't know. It was the case that was attempted quite a bit, I think two different times in the last couple of decades. And then you'd hear that it faded away. And now it seems to be back. Some of it, I suspect, is maybe a little bit the economy, a little bit the kind of book, a little bit the fact that I think there is, including for this novel, younger readers in mind who can just plain, really not just afford the paperback more readily, but they're more used to it. They're more used to the paperback format from the time they were kids and even in college these days. So, you know, there's nothing hard and fast. Nonfiction, Barbara, is a little more hard and fast still. The original is in hardcover.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe not something like the 9/11 Commission report.
Sure.
That is occasional like that.
Mm-hmm.
But for a substantive history, biography, political commentary, and so forth, that has not changed as much vis-a-vis softcover publication.
Hmm. Now, why do certain books or certain authors get reviewed over and over again? And I asked this only because a student brought this up the other night. She said, I just saw another review of Elmore Leonard's book, and, you know, I mean, they're always reviewing Elmore Leonard's book. Now, and so going along with that, I heard something about how, you know, the first book is difficult to get reviewed. Once you have a first book and it gets reviewed, or at least it gets passed around, then it's easier to get a second book reviewed. I mean, is it that name recognition, everybody know, or reviewers know, book editors know that people are interested in Elmore Leonard or other name, you know, big names?
I think so. I think it's that simple. And I don't think that that really gets established to claim that until book three or four. I think even on something like book three, certainly including in Elmore Leonard's genre, in the mystery genre, I'm sure there are a lot of salivating mystery writers, even those on book two and three, who wish they had that regularity of review. So I think if you get it on book two or three, I think that speaks to the quality of what you write, actually, you know, really whatever the genre, and so the cream rises to the top, and some just plain good luck. Some good luck. And then, when you really have a successful pattern, then you can be more assured that, say, books four and five will be better. You can count on that more than even, I think, two or three.
Mm-hmm. Do reviews mean what they used to? Is getting a review in the New York Times or Publishers Weekly as meaningful as it was, say, 3 years ago? Do other forms, you know, there's a lot of internet magazines, there's more happening with different sorts of media. Has it diluted the importance of being reviewed in, say, those two places, USA Today, or are those places as important as ever?
If they're not as important as ever, I would say they have only been slightly affected. And they probably have been. Their full impact has probably been slightly affected even by the reviews available on Amazon.com, where someone browsing there, you know, at least our feeling is, are affected by reading the reviews of their human peers.
Huh.
You know, their fellow man and woman.
Sure.
On Amazon. So I think it has been qualified a bit, Barbara, but I think a bit are the operative words. I still think it's terribly important for the kind of substantive fiction and nonfiction we're talking about. People still do pay attention to the Times and the news magazines, certainly the New Yorker, the Atlantic, etc.
And are bad reviews as worthwhile regardless?
You know they are. I think there's, I may get this Hollywood cliche wrong, but it's something like there is no bad publicity.
Right.
And I know, I mean, I certainly have done enough books over the years that I have, you know, I've had my share of less than great reviews, happily not too many. But I certainly can remember having them and having a publishing friend call me up and say, oh, it's just great to see that review in the Times, John, way to go. And I thought, gee, I don't think Mary really read it because, but, you know, it was the space.
Right.
And I think there's also a feeling that sometimes, with the pace of this country, that the in-brief review, I've heard that about the New Yorker, that the in-briefs count just as much as the long ones, because even some of the faithful readers, you know, including myself, don't always have time for the big review, but you have time to read those four in brief, or in the Times on Sunday, or whatever, you know, whatever paper. So even the little ones count. Yeah, it's still important. I can't give you a percentage of how much that's been qualified, and as I say, it has. But the importance is still there. It's still something that publishers, publicity departments try for, you know, really hard to get that attention.
Interesting. We're going to take a real short break. So all of you out there, stay with us. John Ware will be back for the second half of the show. Do not go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Built in a day, let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I should also say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guests and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. I'm with John Ware today. He's a literary agent in New York City. Hi, John.
Hey, Barbara.
Oh, you know, something that you said earlier, I made a note here. I don't exactly know what it was connected to, but what I wrote down was female characters of over a certain age. Now, I have no idea what you said.
I don't remember saying that.
No, you didn't. You said something, and then I wrote that down. And so let's forget about what prompted me to even write this down. Let me ask you if there's a certain sort of ageism that you've seen in, and I guess I'm talking about fiction, where editors really want novels, if they have main female characters, that these females be under 40 or better yet, closer to 30. Have you seen any of that?
See, honestly, this is the kind of book. What you're really circumscribing in its own way. And yes, there are such. There's even a new imprint. It happens to be in England, not here. But a new imprint designed for, and I'll explain what I think I might have been indirectly alluding to, although I did not say that. But in this case, at this new imprint in England, the name of which I'm blanking on, it is designed for, I think it said the familiar phrase in the paper, women of a certain age.
Yes,
but I'm not too qualified, whether it's women or men, it doesn't matter. Yes, even with some ages in mind, up, down, and middle, because to me, anything with that kind of circumscribing is in effect itself genre. It may not be as, you know, as readily identifiable as such like a mystery or action adventure or romance, but it's still a genre with aims, with aiming at a readership like that, that to me has got to at some point in the execution of those books come to the formulaic. And this is why I put in directories when we are, in some directories, agents are invited to express our list of interests. And under fiction, I always put interested in literate non-category fiction. Mm-hmm. I think I do add on, with the possible exception of mysteries and thrillers, which are, you know, standard genres that almost everybody, including me, reads them. But other than that, I really don't. I'm not interested. I am saying, in effect, in any genre, in any nameable rubric of books, whether it's designed for guys who like gear or women of a certain age. Really,
well,
I'm not interested in the limitations of the genre.
Don't you think you're a little rare, though, when it comes to having that viewpoint as an agent?
Well, again, I have a couple of exceptions that are healthy areas in terms of the mystery, the classic mystery and the classic thriller. So I have a couple of my own. I don't know. It's such a subjective business. I can't honestly even generalize about my colleagues, my fellow agents. I'm sure that there are some of them who feel as I do and some who much prefer their reading to be in a comfortably circumscribed area that I guess is a genre, for lack of a better term. So I don't know if I'm unusual in that or not, honestly.
What about...
Barbara, can I add one thing?
Yeah,
there?
Sure, of course.
I think I think what we're getting near is important to say, and maybe even say with humor, and that is that, yes, we are publishing professionals, editors and literary agents alike, but honestly, we bring our private subjective reading tastes to what we take on, to our work. There's no way around it. You can't get to the passion that I mentioned earlier unless what you're picking up and reading is in accord with something you already loved as a kid or at some point as a private reader.
What I was going to say, which is really sort of taking a little turn, is what about the small presses, small publishers? Are they important in terms? I mean, do you always say go to major publishers to begin with? Do you see value in the smaller presses?
Well, as a publishing person, I certainly see value in them. Absolutely, honestly. It is tough enough to keep all of your knowledge up to date and all of your editorial networks operating as editors jump around in New York, which is still and ever the home of major book publishing. We haven't decentralized much. It honestly is enough for me to cope with in New York so that I do not feel I'm up enough on the smaller presses. I know some of the names and some I don't. And so I really do not submit out of town. I truly know no more than my clients about small presses here and there. I may know some names as they do, but that's really all. I don't really know them. So I do confine my submissions to, it isn't all New York. I mean, for example, I have submitted to Algonquin, a wonderful Southern press that I guess qualifies as small.
Yes.
But, nonetheless, a major player as a Southern press, and in fact, Algonquin is branching out from not trying to get getting away from being pigeonholed as just a publisher of Southern materials. But for the most part, yes, I do. I do work just because that's what I know. That's the terrain I know, and this is still a broad enough terrain here in New York. Enough editorial entities that's really enough for me to cover.
Now, there have been all these sort of merging of houses. Can you, when you are submitting work, can you go to various imprints of, say, Random House and submit the same work, even though, say, these different Random House is the umbrella?
You can. In each case, The only thing I can't tell you, and I don't think any of my peers can keep it straight either, is that I can't remember without calling an agent fan and getting a reminder, or they're calling me, what is the rule for the multiple submissions of that kind that are welcome at every one of the multi-editorial imprint corporations. You can do that all over. But they each have their own set of rules. For example, one of them, each of those entities can bid and continue to bid as separate entities in a competition for a book as long as there's one outside imprint, not part of the corporation. Others of the big combines, they don't have separate bidding. They have one house bid. And at that point, there's more variety because in some cases, the agent gets to pick the imprint from among the multiplicity under the corporate umbrella. And in other cases, the corporation decides, I think, in terms of which editor or which imprint is more passionate, will get the book. So it's almost impossible to keep straight who does what. But yes, they are all open. And that is why I have not felt in any way confined. And you could say, okay, when it comes to affect the bidding, when you have a house bid, it means, for example, that I think this is right about the Bertelsmann Group. They can keep bidding as long as they're an outsider. I think that's Bertelsmann. But what it means is you can't have Random House bidding against Knopf as you could before there was that corporate merger.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, you could probably make a case, and a PhD candidate might even be able to write a dissertation, even with numbers, on how this has affected advances given. But, you know, it doesn't often come up. Barbara, I've never had it happen. I've never been in a situation where I've had competition on a book. It may be sheer chance, because I've certainly made submissions, as I've said, are welcome in every one of them, to a multiplicity of imprints. I have never one time faced the problem.
Hmm. Interesting.
So there's a little restraint of trade in the example that I gave.
Mm-hmm.
If you're within that corporation that does not, where there's only one house bid. But I think it's so what I'm saying is my experience, if that can be called something like restraint of trade, and I hope I won't be sued for use of that term. I'm glad you gave the disclaimer, you know, the opinions of you and me.
That's right. They're ours.
If that's restraint of trade, it comes up so rarely, and in my case, never. That I think that's why you don't hear more vociferous complaining as the years go by from my colleagues. There certainly was outcry as these mergers began to happen. But the outcry doesn't continue because it just doesn't come up. There still are enough entities overall and outside any one that you just don't run into it very often. As I say, in my case, not one time.
Hmm. Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. We are broadcasting out of the UCI campus in Southern California. I'm with John Ware, a literary agent in New York City. I wonder if you will say a few words about promotion in terms of, and here's the thing, a lot of authors are wonderful writers and horrible at promoting themselves. And more it seems that publicists at houses have so many authors to, publicize. And a lot of it is left to authors to do. I know of authors who will fork over their entire advance to an independent publicist to make sure that their book gets out there, they get some appearances, this and that. What do you think about all that? Is it, you think it's balanced the way it is? Do you think publishers should do more so that the authors just can write their next book? I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I think a lot of times because the public wants to see the writer, I think it falls very often on the writer. There's really a double standard here, Barbara, because there's much more of a burden. There's a burden on the novelist to get out and about, to go to reading groups, to give lectures, workshops and so forth, but nothing like the demand that there is for the nonfiction writer, whether that is major media, bookstore appearances. It just is much, there's just much more requirement of the so-called, quote, platform of the nonfiction writer, experience with the media. And by the way, the nonfiction writer on most shows, including yours, radio or TV, are much more interested normally. There are absolutely exceptions, but the great majority of interest is in the nonfiction writer, not the fiction writer. There seems to be this feeling that nonfiction writers are worldly and can talk about their books and other relevant worldly subject matter, whereas the novelist can only talk about their novels.
Where does that come from?
I don't know.
You know,
it's quite unfair to them as people, right? But it really is the case. If you think about certainly major venues like the Today Show or the news programs, unless it's a really big name, you rarely see a novelist. And I'm not just talking in terms of nonfiction about something politically relevant or a psychologist or physician on some new, you know, theory. It isn't just those two areas. It is in general. There's just this feeling that the nonfiction writer from their book has a greater frame of reference to discuss this and that, other issues that spin off from their book, where there really is that presumption that the novelist can pretty much talk about his or her story.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I've been told that by publicists, you know, that you hanker to get their novelists on my show, and they say, you know, there's hardly any venues for novelists.
Yeah, the novelist venues are the much more intimate ones, the reading groups, local literary societies, that kind of thing, in any part of the country. The big venues are much more for nonfiction. Again, whatever the subject matter of the nonfiction.
Yeah. I don't know. It's too bad.
It is too bad, because obviously novelists can speak about many things other than the plot of their latest novel.
Oh, dear. Well, and I want to ask, I thought of a question I don't think I've ever asked you, so I've got to ask you, because I ask everybody else this question that comes on the show, and that is, do you give value to MFA programs? Is an author who has gone through an MFA program more valuable to you or not? Does it matter to you as an agent, and do you see it mattering to editors?
Well, it's a plus. I have a client from your, are you speaking from Irvine?
Yeah.
I have a client who has a little brown novelist named Elise Blackwell. I have a client who got her MFA there, right there, where you were broadcasting from. You know, it's a plus probably when you read the query letter. It's certainly not a liability. And maybe when you're reading the query letter, number one, it sounds good, an MFA from a reputable program. And also, in addition to just plain sounding good or reads nicely when you read it, I think maybe a little part of you says, well, you know, there was some good nuts and bolts discipline instilled here. So it probably is a plus in the finished quality of the work and overall execution of what they do. But, you know, it's helpful, but it certainly is not necessary. It's not a necessity. Is it a plus? Sure. Sure, it's a plus. It is something I'm not ever disappointed to read listed in a short paragraph of resume in a query letter. How does it come to play down the road in terms of their discipline, their work habits, the finished quality of their work? I'm not sure. I think once a writer, whatever their background before they come to books, when they get installed with agent and editor in tow, that discipline and those work habits and seriousness of purpose, and I think that all can be instilled. I still say it's a plus. It certainly doesn't hurt for a writer who's considering, you know, that sort of training. to refine their interests. I certainly would never discourage anybody, and it's never, ever a liability. I mean, you never would look at it and say, oh, probably they've been pigeonholed into, you know, some very academic habits from that training. Never. Yeah, you would never say that.
What about school? Does it matter? Does it matter where they got their MFA? If they were in a low residency program or UCI, I mean, is there a great difference?
I don't know. I think that they're probably, maybe from the standpoint of a publisher and what they would put on the jacket, maybe it sounds better to have received it from Iowa or Irvine or Pittsburgh, to name three good programs, than, I don't know, a university with a fledgling program.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, that it probably helps. But in terms of the training imparted, I still think it's not worse than nothing. If I see something with an MFA from a small school, I don't think, oh, they would have been better off not to go.
They should have stayed home.
Right.
Well, why'd they do that for? You're listening to Writers on Writing. I have a few more minutes with John Ware, who is a literary agent in New York, and he is able to be found in various directories if you want to contact him. That'd be the best thing is to look at Writer's Market or Jeff Herman's book, and some of these resource directories, and you'll find him. Have you any opinion on the size of novels, or do you see it changing? I mean, there are little books. I see more little books coming out than ever, it seems. I mean, there's still the standard size and all.
I'm shocked that the trend... Sorry, were you finished?
Yeah, pretty much.
I'm shocked that the trend seems to have gone the other way. Elise Blackwell's first novel, which I mentioned, which was called Hunger, that I placed with an enthusiastic little brown, was 108-page manuscript. I literally was afraid it was too small categorically to even show. And actually, when I called around, I called editor friends on that one score alone. And I think I sent it to seven houses. One house, who I will leave nameless, one major house, the editorial director said, yeah, really, however good it is, it really is just too short at 108.
Huh.
But they're the only ones.
Yeah.
And certainly, Little Brown did add some leading, so it came up to, I don't know, it's across the room here, but it's, you know, 140 pages, something like that. But what interests me is that it's going in the other direction with, I'm trying to think of something in Mrs. Norell.
Oh, Jonathan Strange and
Jonathan
Mr. Norell.
Jonathan Strange and Mrs. Norell, the Bloomsbury bestseller, which has got to be, I think it's up around 700
Huge.
Or something.
Yeah, it's
like that.
I think it's wider than Underworld in terms of height or width.
Yeah, it seems to be an odd sometimes, and we're only thinking of that one, Barbara. There were a couple of others last year. And so there was this wonder of, oh, my gosh, we shouldn't even try anything that isn't 700 pages. That seems to go the other way. Truthfully, I try to avoid observing any such trends, really. Because it's all about individual books.
Yes.
And their merits. but, yeah, I mean, there seems to be no maximum, I guess. I don't know whether 700 is the limit. I think the 108 is the limit going down.
Well, then I think about, you know, Steinbeck or Hemingway. I mean, there's these little books. They had a few there, you know. It's just, I guess if it's strong, then who cares on it?
Well, that's what I'm
trying
to say. If it's strong, you go with it. And obviously there are some long books that are very engaging all the way. And it's not a problem.
Yeah, The Great Gatsby. What that?
No, Gatsby's a pretty normal length. I mean, even Steinbeck. Steinbeck is longer than Hemingway, I believe. I mean, Steinbeck was sort of not very long, but Hemingway, I tend to think of as shorter.
Yeah.
In the shorter realm, Steinbeck, I think of as sort of normal. Maybe I'm misremembering some of his books a while since I read him.
We have about 3 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you about short stories and short story collections, and if you handle those.
I handle those, but, you know, there's an extra hurdle. for the short story writer that the first novelist doesn't have. The first novelist's work can be completely uninformed by credentials, totally. The writer can be completely unschooled in any way, and if that's a fine piece of sustained storytelling, novel length, it can be readily published. The short story writer for his or her collection really has to have major credits for about half of the individual stories, certainly a few of them, to get a publisher's attention. It's a complete double standard. Very difficult. It is really almost impossible to place a collection of stories by someone starting out in the same way that a novelist would start out. Just sit down and write.
Sure.
Seems silly.
Yeah.
But.
Oh, well.
it's the case.
When an agent or editor says that a book is selling well or has sold well, what does that mean?
It's really hard to.
What do they hope for in terms of, you know, do they hope that a first book sells 5,000 copies, 10,000 copies? And this is a book that obviously doesn't make bestseller lists.
Barbara, it's so hard because there's just no science even to a remark like that. I'm not sure we know what we mean in terms of hard numbers. I mean, I think there's probably something about, say, with the first book, about five figures, about 10,000 as a nice, healthy start, certainly for a literary first novel, where five is a little low. And that, I think that's just the psychology of five numbers. But it's really hard to fill that in numerically in any way by what we mean when we say that.
Well,
sorry to demur.
No, that's okay. I just hear from writers whose first book comes out and everybody's so anxious about their book selling and their editor continuing to like them and their agent continuing to like them. There's just such a sort of, you know, bordering on, you know, obsessing over Amazon rankings and all that.
Well, you know, there's some reason for that. It's tough to take up with a minute to go or whatever we have. But I think that, there can be quite a fickle reading public out there. And if you don't please them to some degree, again, the question is to what degree, the first time out, you might not have as much success in placing that second novel. And I think that's some of the anxiety, because I think in older times, there was much more patience by publishers with writers. They went along with a writer. They gave them whatever. They gave them three books, four books to make their way. Now there's much more impatience. If you don't establish some corner of the marketplace, whatever the numbers, there really is a concern about taking on that second novel.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily high numbers. It's whatever is subjectively felt on that book is a good start, whatever that means. But that's the anxiety, is that there's not that commitment in spirit or in fact anymore to a writer's growing period and growing pains over three or four books. You really have to, each book has to make its way or the next book, you know, is a jeopardized property when it comes in.
Oh, it's been wonderful talking with you again.
I wonder if
you have any advice or words of wisdom for the writers listening.
Well, only one, and that is ignore us agents and ignore us editors. Ignore the publishing world. Just concentrate on that piece of work that you're working on that you, I hope, love, which is why you're working on it, and shine it to a fare thee well. And then and only then start to think about publishing. Just do your craft.
Yes.
That's what counts. And then you will be welcomed in if you've done your job.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Barbara.
You're welcome.
Talk to you.
That was John Ware. He's a literary agent in New York City. And I always like talking to him. He's so articulate and refreshing, you know? Anyway. We are through. We're at the end of our time. If you want to know more about the show, you can go to penonfire.com. Email me from there if you like, if you want to know who's going to be on every week. And I'm going to leave you with a quote by Raymond Chandler, who said, The faster I write, the better my output. If I'm going slow, I'm in trouble. It means I'm pushing the words instead of being pulled by them. Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week.